VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and we thank you for joining us. In the studio with us today, it's Alison Rudd. Down the line, it's Ollie Kay.
It's been a weekend where shocking events off the field have overshadowed football. On Saturday night, after Leicester City's game with West Ham, the Leicester owner, Vishay Srivaddhanaprabha, was among those to lose his life when a helicopter carrying him and four others crashed outside the King Power Stadium. Under his stewardship, Leicester, despite odds of 5,000 to 1, won the Premier League title in 2016, perhaps the most incredible league title victory in the history of English football. Henry Winter spent Sunday at the King Power Stadium and joins us now. Henry, the city of Leicester is in mourning, and he really did have a special bond with the players and the fans.
Yeah, and it wasn't just the city, it was the whole county, and it stretches beyond that, you know, around the world, obviously to Thailand, where Vishay was born and where his business empire is. So, no, I mean, it's huge. What I found particularly interesting and moving yesterday, and that's the outpouring of emotion. All very quiet, all very respectful. No one raised their voices. I mean, really, all you could hear at times was just the sort of rustle of the cellophane around the flowers. But the outpouring of emotion on social media, and also people from other clubs turning up and leaving tributes to say, you know, we're Liverpool, we stand by you. We're Celtic, we stand by you. You know, we're Nottingham Forest, Wolves, local rivals, Derby County. You know, fans from those clubs. And I think there was a broader element here, is that people appreciated, they almost wanted Vishay to be owner of their club. And, you know, Leicester, you know, he chose Leicester. And we all know the extraordinary eight-year journey that they've been on, particularly with the title. So I just think he struck a chord with fans throughout football as well as within the city of Leicester.
He was also so emotionally invested in Leicester, as you say, Henry. He donated millions, didn't he, to the Leicester Infirmary and to Leicester University?
He did. It was interesting talking to a couple of the local radio reporters who cover the club on a daily basis, new Vishay, a Leicester City fan themselves, and you know, they just talked of the little things. Whenever he saw them, he would shake their hands and wish them well, ask after their family. He was quite sort of almost old school paternal in that sense, and that sort of emotional largesse, you know, extended to financial largesse, you say, with 2 million to help the children's hospital, £1 million to the university, and just all sorts of things, like, you know, the fans talked about what he did for them on his birthday. There'd be sort of free beer, and it might seem little things, but in an age when owners increasingly are distanced from fans and fans feel increasingly disenfranchised, Vishay was trying to reverse that trend, not because he wanted to be different from other owners, but because he was just wanting to be him, and that involved being community-minded. And so, look, the whole city of Leicester has lost a great man. But I think also football has as well, and someone who I think certain other owners could have learned from.
I was struck by, when I heard the news, by the parallel with another helicopter crash, I think roughly 20 years ago, involving Matthew Harding at Chelsea, who had also poured enormous amounts of money at the club, was also very much invested in the club, going to the pub with fans before games and stuff like that. and who also had a tremendous impact as well, because certainly without Matthew Harding, there would have been no sort of Hoddle, Hullett, Vialli at Stamford Bridge, and there probably would have been no Roman Abramovich either. Alison's signalling to me. Alison.
Just that I wrote his book. I was going to write his... He asked me, Matthew Harding, I knew him really well, and he asked me to help him ghost his biography. And then a few months later, he died in that helicopter crash. And I decided, out of a sense of duty, perhaps, I would carry on writing it. It was a really difficult book to write because he was, like so many chairmen of football clubs, his non-football activity was quite mysterious and maybe slightly dodgy as well. So lots of people were, like, you know, trying to piece together how he got his money together and what sort of business money was. And what
reinsurance,
his,
wasn't it?
It was reinsurance, but it was complicated. It wasn't just straightforward. And the world of reinsurance is complicated. So I had to put together a picture of what makes somebody want to become the impetus behind a club that they love. But yes, it's similar in that the fans of Chelsea had just started to really warm to Matthew Harding. They didn't get a chance to know him well enough, but he was magnanimous. He was the opposite of Ken Bates, who he ended up being in a rivalry with. And Ken Bates didn't like him at all. But Ken Bates recognised that Harding's cash gave the club breathing space. And you're quite right, that breathing space was necessary for a big billionaire to come in the form of Roman Abramovich and buy the club. If they hadn't had that breathing space, it might not have been such an attractive proposition to Abramovich at all.
I mean, you only have to read the messages on social media from fans and from players to just realise the impact that he made at the club. The theme of his big heart, his generosity, the love that everyone had for him, it just shines through from what everyone's written. Kasper Schmeichel called Srivadana Prava an inspiration. He said the owner apparently told him when he signed for Leicester in 2011, when they were in the Championship, that they would be in the Champions League within 6 years. And Ollie, he was proved absolutely right.
Yeah, he was. And if you look at the period from when they took over, as so many new owners upon taking over clubs do, you could tell that there were sort of perhaps agents pulling the strings at an early stage and sort of they were being influenced to some extent by people they knew or whatever. And you saw them appointing Sven-Göran Eriksson, which I think is a symptom of that. And Eriksson did a fairly average job. And then I think they appointed football people. They had people like John Ruckin advising them. If you look at the decisions they made over that period, the decisions were so good. It's not just appointing Nigel Pearson. It's keeping faith with Nigel Pearson through some difficult times early on, keeping faith with him after they lost out in the playoffs heartbreakingly, when I think the default mode of a lot of new chairmen would have been to sack him and so on. Then take them up the next season, stick with them all of that season. And then there was a difficult situation where, for reasons off the pitch, Nigel Pearson ended up out of a job. Then they made a decision to hire Claudio Ranieri, which was ridiculed at the time, widely ridiculed. And it was so inspired. And if you look at the way the football club has been run, it's not perfect. They've made a few mistakes here and there, but their decisions they make have been very, very good. Even the young players that they've targeted, perhaps the last two transfer windows, not the one immediately post-title when they made a few mistakes, but the last two summers, they've made really good appointments. And I think of all of that sort of middle tier of clubs, I think they are the ones who have not just with the outlier of the title winning season, but they've made good decisions. They've invested ambitiously, aggressively, but intelligently a lot of the time in young players. I think everything they've done, even on the pitch, as well as all off the pitch, which is stuff which is terribly important as well, which Henry referred to, they've just made good decisions. And they're clever people, not so hands-on that they were afraid to take advice from more experienced people in football circles, but also not so aloof that they were prepared to be hands-off and just let the club run itself like so many owners do. It was always very hands-on, but in a way that ensured that expertise was influencing their decisions. And I just think if you look at the owners, not just throughout the Premier League and throughout English football, there are not many, there really are not many that would prompt this level of outpouring from their fans. I think there are a lot of owners who are
tolerated. There are a lot of owners who are reviled. And these guys genuinely were loved by Leicester fans and admired, I think, by other clubs' fans. And I think it is just a tragedy. It's above all a tragedy on a human level and for the families concerned. We should never lose sight of that. But as a football podcast and about football, it's a terrible loss to Leicester City Football Club and to the Premier League as a whole.
We're joined now by the Asia editor for The Times, Richard Lloyd Parry. And Richard, tell us about the impact of this news in Thailand and across Asia as well.
Well, certainly in Thailand, it's huge news, of course. And I think people are very shocked. I mean, Mr. Vichai, in his home country, of course, was known not only as the owner of Leicester City, but as one of the country's biggest and richest businessmen. He made his fortune running, essentially had a monopoly on selling duty-free in Thailand's biggest airports, which in a tourist destination as big as that, you can imagine is very good, very big business indeed. And he had shares in airlines. He had he owned, I think, a Belgian football team. But Leicester's spectacular success in 2016 was, of course, huge news in Thailand. And Thais were very proud of Mr. Vichai. Thailand is a football crazy country, although it's and they do love the Premiership, although it's dominated by Liverpool to some extent, but Manchester United above all. But you know, the success of this team owned by a Thai did encourage quite a lot of Thai fans to defect from Manchester United to Leicester. So you know, it's a huge and terrible shock.
And of course, we should also remember that two pilots and two members of his staff were also in. Of course, thoughts go out to their families as well. Now, all around, it was a pretty awful Saturday, and it began with the news of the former England and Spurs manager Glenn Hoddle collapsing at BT Sports Studios on Saturday morning after suffering a heart attack. As we record this, the reports are that he's in a serious condition, but is responding to treatment. He's obviously somebody who is a big voice within football. Matthew Syed wrote very eloquently about sort of his time in the 1980s. I think a lot of us grew up with him being so different from the rest of English football. Henry, can you talk a bit about Glenn? In your experience?
Well, if he was French, Spanish, Italian, you know, he would have had probably 130, 140 caps. I mean, he was wasted by England. He was just, you know, he was a remarkable footballer from an incredibly young age, playing for his father's Sunday league team. And when I wrote a book on England a few years back, I knew I needed to get Hoddle because he was, as a player and as a manager, he was a brilliant England manager, apart from a fairly key issue with man management. But he tactically, he was brilliant. He played players in the right place. He had Rio Ferdinand sort of emerging. He played Scholes in his best position. He had the right balance. England at 98, the Italy game beforehand to qualify, tactically got it absolutely spot on with the way he used Ian Wright as a lone run front runner, wearing the Italians down. He was brilliant there to get the draw they needed to qualify. And then out of the World Cup himself, even in adversity against Argentina, when Beckham foolishly got sent off, England were terrific. The way that Glenn, with his tactical nous, got Michael Owen and Alan Shearer playing out wide where Beckham had been, and you know, taking in turns to shuttle up and down the flank, he was absolutely brilliant. Really, really good manager. But just as a player, you go back to those very early ages when it was the dark ages in English football, and there were dinosaurs roaming across the pitch. And Glenn, he told me about what it was like when he was playing for his father's Sunday league team. He was about sort of 13, 14, with this sumptuous skill, and he was sort of dribbling past people, and these real hard ethics types, you know, would just say to him, "Do that again, and we're going to break your leg." And he would carry on. And people, you know, the whole Glenda thing, as he was slightly derided, you know, he was tough because he had to be tough because he had all that skill, and he knew he was going to get nailed. The thing about Glenn Hoddle is that people listen to him on the
television. I know he divides opinions. If you sit down with Glenn Hoddle, you have an hour in his company just talking football. It's just enlightening. I mean, I've long talked to the FA, and as ever with these things, fail to try and get him to have some role at the heart of St George's Park to bring his vision alongside a more nuts and bolts admin man like Dan Ashworth, who's now leaving on. And I think it's been very encouraging in recent months where Gareth Southgate invited him back into the fold. You saw Harry Maguire tweeted that picture of the weekend about how proud he was to have met Glenn Hoddle. Hoddle going into the dressing room, passing the shirts on to some of the new players as well. You know, English football hasn't used Glenn Hoddle properly, and he really has been the prophet in his own land, but ignored, which is sad. And you can see that the Sunday papers did him proud with all their sort of comments and observations on what a magnificent football man he is. And we should remember that. But we also should remember that the FA and English football and England managers didn't treat Glenn Hoddle properly.
I think from all of us here, we want Glenn to get well real soon and to see him back out there.
On the field, it was a fine afternoon at Turf Moor for a couple of English football's brightest prospects. Chelsea ran out 4-0 winners at Burnley on Sunday. Ross Barkley shining again. He scored for the third Premier League game in a row, the first English player to do that for Chelsea since Frank Lampard 5 years ago. Ollie, you were there. How impressive is Barkley right now?
Extremely impressive, yeah. I mean, I think people were guilty of forgetting just how good a player he had been in his sort of breakthrough couple of seasons at Everton. And perhaps, if you go back to the 2013-14 season, he was so good for Everton under Roberto Martinez. And I think because Martinez would lay it on very thick and compare him to Michael Ballack or Iniesta or whoever he happened to be speaking in the way Martinez speaks, I think people sort of didn't take him as seriously as they should have done. But he's always had a real talent. I don't think he really had kicked on over the last 2 or 3 years under different managers, under Koeman and obviously the injuries at Everton last season, then the move to Chelsea, which didn't work out at all initially. But I think what we're seeing now is a young player who has still got a lot of development to do, but has got so many of the raw materials and so many good technical qualities. And we're seeing him being indulged and trusted and encouraged by a manager in Sarri who loves that kind of player, loves technical players, loves energetic technical players in particular. And he is thriving. He really is thriving. I know people will talk about it being just a few games and, it was only Burnley yesterday, but it was a defence-splitting pass against Spain a couple of weeks before that. It's been very good performances all along. He's been weighing in with goals. And although people will look at the goal yesterday as being the sort of high point of his performance, I thought the pass, the instinctive sort of control and pass for the first goal from Morata, where it was so quick, and it came from Jorginho, Pedro, Kante, then to Barkley, and Barkley sort of controlled it and passed it almost in one movement to Morata, who scored, and it was just a really, really good performance by a player who really is thriving, and it's really good to see, because if he's on form, I think he walks into the England team. I really do.
Well, it's certainly very promising for England. Yeah. Alison?
Yeah, no, it's. I think we're going to end up talking about Sarri the way we talked about Pochettino and just helping English players, because Sarri said he's got these young players at Chelsea, and some of them we don't even talk about because they're all out on loan or whatever. But he says, in English football, there is technical ability. He believes it's there, and the physicality and the pace that you were talking about, Ollie. But he says tactically they're a bit behind. And then you think, oh, is that true? And then Ross Barkley himself says, I just wasn't taught. I was just, because I had talent, no one taught me how to be tactical. And I mean, it is a bit of a crying shame, because imagine what would have happened 5 years ago if someone had said, look at that technically gifted young Englishman. What he just needs is a bit more awareness of what to do with the teammates he's got, and we could have a superstar on our hands. It hasn't come too late for him, but it could have been better if it had come earlier. And if this is the way Sarri's looking at what he's inherited, that he can make technically good players better tactically, then that and well, for whatever nationality they are, they're going to be blossoming onto the world stage, aren't they? They're going to be improved players. I find that instructive and refreshing.
It's funny. I think there's a bit of a sliding doors element to this as well, in the sense that one of the reasons Barkley has developed so much is that when Sarri came and showed up, his first training session for Chelsea, there were like 10 people there. Maybe not 10, there were a few more, but you know what I mean? Like Loftus-Cheek famously was not there because he was, he'd been to the World Cup. Mm. And so Sarri was in a situation, Kovacic wasn't there, hadn't returned yet. So he was in a situation where he had to work with what he had. There was no Conte, obviously. And what he found was, God, this guy can really play. This guy's got serious skills. And while I wonder, as a manager, you have a finite amount of teaching that you can do. It's sort of like in school where, if you've got a smaller class size as opposed to a larger class size, I do wonder if there had been no World Cup this summer, whether, how things might have panned out differently, how maybe Barkley wouldn't have had all that one-on-one attention early on, which allowed him to develop such a relationship and a trust with Sarri. Maybe it would have gone to Loftus-Cheek instead. It's always odd. And we often don't appreciate the fact that these are human beings who build relationships, especially, for guys who aren't necessarily considered superstars by their club, but sort of just another guy in the squad, which I think is where Barkley and indeed Loftus-Cheek were at the beginning of the summer. I wonder about Loftus-Cheek, though. He scores a hat-trick in midweek. People were joking about how he wasn't getting in the squad. Ha, ha, ha. Obviously, he gets in the squad this week. He's on the bench, also because Hazard's not there. Pedro gets injured. He comes on. He scored late. Is that his position, the one he was playing in? Is that where Sarri sees him, or was it a case of perhaps Sarri wanting to shoehorn him into the side just to make sure he kind of kept the momentum going and he got a look at him against real opposition?
Yeah, I think it was the latter, really. I don't think many people would see his position being sort of wide in a front three. It was great that he scored and he played okay in the second half, but he wasn't at the level of Barkley. He wasn't at the level that you would expect of Pedro in that position or of Hazard or Willian in that position. I think the reality is that they have three, arguably four players competing for one of the three places in central midfield, and they're Barkley, they're Kovacic, Loftus-Cheek and Fabregas. And it's to Barkley's immense credit if he's going to emerge as the one, or even as one of the two, alternating with Kovacic. But Loftus-Cheek, I found it slightly uncomfortable where the other night where people are sort of talking about him having actually proved he can do it at this level when it's a performance against, who was it, Bats Borisov in the Europa League. I wouldn't have thought that was the greatest performance of his career at the highest level. It didn't have to be, but he's a player who was in the England squad last season or for the World Cup because he performed to a certain level. And I think the level now required of him to get into Chelsea's, even on Chelsea's bench this season, is probably higher than the level he had to get into the England squad. I think he's at the wrong club this season. I think it's right that they should view him as a long-term prospect, but if they were to, having signed Kovacic, having reintegrated Barkley with Fabregas already in your and Kante and Jorginho, I think the ideal thing for him at 22, is it? Yeah, 22, 23 in January, would be to be playing week in, week out like he was at Paris last season.
I think Sarri perhaps to some degree learned his lesson last season about the lack of rotation. And I think we might see more of it as people become more comfortable. I think one of the issues, spoken to maybe one or two members of Chelsea's coaching staff, is that if you send Loftus-Cheek back out and he goes to play, well, like last year with Roy Hodgson, does he really develop? Or does he just kind of play as like, yeah, you're the freewheeling attacking midfielder and, we have Wilfred Zaha here and, you get the ball to him and then you shoot from 30 yards out. And it's just a totally different experience. And I'm not saying that Hodgson's a bad coach or they play bad tactically. No, but they play tactically the way a team like Crystal Palace should play in their position. So I think there's a dynamic there where, from the club's perspective, they're not sure how much benefit he actually gets if he goes out.
But isn't there also the learning of other players and being around other players?
So that's the Phil Foden argument.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, there's nowhere Phil Foden could go. Yeah, I'm sure Phil Foden might be good enough to start for half the teams in the Premier League. Mm. But is that necessarily going to help his development right now, as Ollie said? I'm not sure.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Alison, you were at Craven Cottage on Saturday to see yet another wayward defensive display from Fulham. But first of all, let's talk about their opponents, Bournemouth. They were 3-0 winners. They're gate-crashing the top six at present. They're having their best start to a Premier League season.
Yeah, and well, God, I hate the phrase deservedly so, but they are a very, very well-run team at the moment. And it was instructive to compare and contrast with Fulham, because Bournemouth were everything that Fulham need and don't have at the moment. Bournemouth were incredibly well-organised, efficient, compact, patient. They were so grown up. They were exactly what you expect from a team that actually believes they could break into the top six by the end of the season. There was something very, not arrogant about them, but they knew exactly what they were doing. They controlled the tactics of the game. They went there full of confidence, but put in a huge amount of effort. They surprised Fulham with their formation. That was a great tactical piece of genius from Eddie Howe. They went three at the back and suddenly used pace on the wings in sort of spurts, and Fulham became split. It was instructive to see just the character of the team. And also afterwards, I know people bang on about how much they love Eddie Howe, and you sort of think, really, really, just another manager. But he is so impressive when he talks about the team. He never, ever accepts any of it as, he never does the me thing. There's no ego there. And there's this young player they signed from Sheffield United called David Brooks. I mean, he's 21, but he looks about 14. But he's in stunning form at the moment. I mean, I hadn't seen him play before. He's remarkable. But Eddie Howe asked about him. He says, oh, no, it's not. We didn't even have to do much video analysis with him. We didn't really have to talk to him about how to play football. He's just a technically gifted guy who's working really hard and buying into what we do here. He's not saying, yeah, I worked really hard with him and I identified his talent and I knew what I was buying. He more or less accepts, you know, we do scout, but we got lucky that we've got somebody here who, most importantly to Howe, buys into the fact that you do not score a goal and think you're the bee's knees. He says he comes back in early and he wants to learn more, and that's what we expect from our players.
Well, so, but then we often hang on managers' comments, right? But we've seen this with Bournemouth before, where, you know, they've spent a lot of money on players and then they haven't worked out. Other times, you know, they go back to guys who've been with them a couple years ago, or, you know, they find guys internally like Fraser turn out to be phenomenal, or, you know, you think of Lewis Cook, who they spent, I think, a lot of money on when he was very young, and then he basically didn't play for a year. Then he comes in, he becomes an England international. I'm just mystified by what goes on inside that man's head. And I think, actually, and it's great that he's humble And obviously, I don't think any manager says, hey, you know, Loftus-Cheek, oh, now that you've scored a goal, I really want you to walk around with swagger and think you're the bee's knees. I mean, everybody's going to preach humility. What I find interesting is I think he just sees the game differently. There's no Josh King, no problem. Callum Wilson, who I think you spoke to recently, I remember speaking to somebody at the club a year and a bit ago, and they're saying, well, he's not the same player since his injury. He's also a bit lazy. I don't think he's going to work out here. And now he's back in vogue. I just don't understand this man. Like, what he's doing is brilliant, and it really is remarkable because, you know, what people forget is, yeah, they've spent a lot of money, but so have many other clubs. And yes, we can go back and say giving Jermaine Defoe all that money was probably not the cleverest thing he's done. But, you know, you get some right, you get some wrong. And you look at this on balance, and it's absolutely remarkable that they're even in the Premier League, let alone in the top 10, and let alone having done it over several seasons.
But you say you don't get what's going on in his head. Is he not just somebody who, rather than bemoan the fact it's a relatively small club with a relatively small budget, I mean, there's no such thing as a tiny amount of money anymore, but he's not working with the big figures, and he can't attract someone like Paul Pogba to the club. Rather than wish it was different, he's turned it into a positive. It's a sort of twilight world between somewhere like a club that's unfashionable and do that sort of create barriers and it's us against the world. He hasn't created that. He's made them a warm, likable club. There's no sense of us against them, but he's somehow found an identity there that, rather than rail against the limitations, he's made every single thing he has an advantage.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt that. But the thing is, along the way, we see this situation where some of the players, they always stay at the club, but they kind of come in, they become important, and then they sort of disappear to the margins. I mean, Callum Wilson, I think, is actually a really good example of this. You could maybe make a case for Lewis Cook as well. I mean, for them to spend that kind of money, right, when they signed him, and it was a lot of money for a young player back then, and I believe he was an under-21 international at the time or whatever else, and then this guy doesn't set foot on the pitch. And what I was told is, well, you know, he had to learn the ways here and blah, 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 and Andrew Sermon was more productive for... I mean, I don't think Andrew Sermon is a good footballer, but he's obviously a good professional and is ideal in many ways for what Bournemouth want. And getting into that mindset, and then Lewis Cook plays, and then he's a difference maker. You know what I'm saying?
Like, okay,
you don't get the luxury of that patience many times at other clubs. So obviously Eddie Howe's
which is why he stayed, probably, because he knows he will have the luxury of that time. But he said it again on after the game at Fulham. He said, I expect... flair players, wide players, attacking players, I expect them to do their tracking back and work really hard and be disciplined. Maybe he's just one of those managers who says it, but means it. No, but he means it. And he's not under pressure from the owners or the fans or from the fact he might have spent a lot of money to keep playing the player, even though he's asking him to track back and he isn't. He will say, you're a great technical player, but until you learn your role in the team and you're able to be defensive in the way that we operate, you're not coming back in. So the player learns, he comes back in. It's actually quite simple.
Well, let's talk about a player you mentioned, Callum Wilson, who is having a very good season. He's been involved in 9 goals already, 5 goals and 4 assists. Only Eden Hazard has been involved in more.
Jadon Sancho's having a better season, so there.
We're not talking about Borussia Dortmund. We're talking about Bournemouth right now and Callum Wilson. Obviously, we've mentioned that you were there, that you saw the game. Just how good is Callum Wilson right now? And bear in mind that you've mentioned Jadon Sancho. We've already spoken about Ross Barkley and Ruben Loftus-Cheek in England. Is he someone that should be involved with England as well?
Well, Eddie Howe said he has to be on Gareth Southgate's radar right now. And he does, doesn't he? He hasn't had a call up to the senior squad. He's played for the under-21s. He's close to being one of those players in unplayable form. Because certainly, and I mean, it's, you know, the Fulham defence is a mess. So maybe that's not the greatest judge of how effective a striker is at the moment. But he had them wrapped around his little fingers. So, little finger. He was, I mean, if he felt he drew them into fouls they shouldn't have made. He's very good at winning free kicks. I'm not saying he cheats, but he knows how to go down with the right amount of pressure. He knows how to invite the right amount of pushing and tugging tripping and so on. He's powerful, he's fast, he's confident, cool. I mean, if I was Gareth Southgate, I'd just for that characteristic, I'd want him around, because I think he'd certainly buoy the camp up with that sort of. When he's playing well, he's got a slight aura about him. He certainly deserves an England call-up.
It's time now for some quick hits, and Arsenal were held to a 2-2 draw at Crystal Palace, ending their winning streak at 11. Alison, Roy Hodgson not happy. How did the match officials miss Lacazette's obvious handball in the build-up to Aubameyang's goal? And should we have retrospective punishment for this sort of thing?
Well, they missed. It's not weird that they missed it. It took me 6 viewings to be absolutely sure it was a handball. It was very quick. If you accept
his arms above his head,
no, his arms up. It's not absolutely clear that he directs the ball anywhere until you watch it from a certain angle, and then you go from thinking was that a handball to thinking, oh my goodness, that was the cleverest handball I've ever seen in my life, because he flicks it into the absolutely perfect place. It's just, and with his back to play, amazing. But then you think,
if he'd been a defensive player, wouldn't you give a penalty for that? Or would you say, oh, look, it's entirely accidental. It's not. If that had been a defender with his arm raised way above his head.
If he was sure to touch the arm. I think from certain angles, it looked like it skimmed beyond the reach of his fingers, actually. So that's why I'm saying it was hard to see first time in real time. It took a few viewings to see that there might have been contact. So I don't blame the officials at all. And as for retrospective action, to impose a punishment on him, you'd have to accept that he was trying to be very clever and do something with the ball, and I'm not sure that we can conclude that. And also, retrospectively, where do you begin and end it? I'm not keen on too much retrospective stuff, because you could end up with a sort of long, long, long list of things, and looking at the team sheet for the next match and wondering why on earth all of them are missing, because they're all serving suspensions for things that you just can't remember happening. But it turns football into bureaucracy, so I'd rather limit that.
I agree with you on that, but it would also be, Lacazette knows that he touched the ball. May not have been intentional, but he knows he touched the ball. And he knows that his team gained an advantage from it because they then scored. I wish we had an environment where people were encouraged to come out and say, hey, ref, it was me. You know, simple as that.
Well, it's a bit like Kemar Roofe for Leeds when he scored the equaliser, wasn't it? Was it the equaliser?
Are you referencing the Football League again?
I am, yes. But he scored with his hand, didn't he, for Leeds the other night? And it was only at the end when he said, well, if the ref's going to give it, he's going to give it.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a wonderful attitude to engender. But then, listen, if we're going to do...
Granit Xhaka was honest.
Right, sorry?
Granit Xhaka was honest.
Granit Xhaka is a good person. Manchester United overcome Everton 2-1, and Paul Pogba misses a penalty after a very, 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 very long run-up. I was actually tempted to throw 28 varies in there,
which would have been good.
According to our high-tech calculations in the Times, he took 28 steps for this one. According to the BBC, it was merely 26, but of course we all know they have trouble counting. The weird thing is, he took a penalty against Brighton this year when he took a mere 8 steps. Socrates, of course, the legendary Socrates, would often take no steps. And listen, any clever theories on steps and run-ups and whatnot?
Well, my theory was that he missed against Burnley and only took 20 steps, but he scored against Young Boys having taken 25. So he thought, clearly the more steps I take, he's thinking short term, clearly the more steps I take, the better. And that didn't work. So he has now gracefully admitted he needs to completely rethink his whole step routine.
I obviously, when somebody doesn't score a penalty, it's always their fault and it's never down the goalkeeper. But if there's one where you could actually say the goalkeeper reacted well and did well.
Not that well, though. He gave the ball straight back to him. A great keeper would have put it somewhere else.
Whatever.
Ah, oh, okay. Who remembers when we were all concerned about Mo Salah's goal scoring? No more, of course. He's now scored 4 in his last 3, and Jurgen Klopp is using his whole squad, unlike last year. Cardiff lost 4-1 at the weekend. Alison, how happy are you right now?
I'm getting happier. Happier, yes. No, I mean, it's. I'm struggling to think of something original to say because I think it's all been said, but the key to why Liverpool might just win the title this season is that Klopp does have a much bigger squad and a squad with talent in it, and he seems pretty adept at keeping those players who aren't starting happy. And he talks beautifully about the players who come in and help him out. So I think Shaqiri got some love this weekend. He's a great man manager. He's able to rotate. He's also very good at noting which of the stars might need a bit of a rest and noting who on the bench is ready to come in. So he's doing everything that he didn't do in his first couple of seasons. He's doing it now. You asked me if I was happy, so you're going to get a sort of stream of consciousness of reasons why I'm getting happier.
One word answer. Which Liverpool player do you think is hardest for Klopp to replace?
Virgil van Dijk.
Yep. I'd agree with that. Correct.
You passed.
Gerard Deulofeu scores a worldie as Watford beat up Huddersfield 3-0. But Alison, what really excites many, including people who put the game together, is Watford's midfield. Roberto Pereira, Abdoulaye Doucouré, Will freaking Hughes. No, seriously, listen, since everybody can be, you know, an England international right now, why not him? That's a pretty special group, isn't it?
Yeah, it's special because it's really nicely balanced. And I like the fact that Will Hughes joined Watford and he did get that tag of maybe being a luxury player. And he has admitted himself he had to learn how to mix the talent and the flair with just hard work, tracking back. It seems to be a theme of answers today. And he's done it. So they're one of those midfields where they click. And when one of them's trying to be imaginative, the others will be solid and they back each other up. And they've got good work ethic, energy and vision. And they're a unit. And I admire any manager that can incorporate Will Hughes because I've always been a fan of his flair. And I haven't liked the way he sort of would often get substituted or seem to sort of slowly become flimsy during a match. He seems to have found that robustness that he needed.
Fun fact about Roberto Pereira,
which
I haven't looked up to see if it's accurate, but somebody who knows their stuff tweeted this the other day. Roberto Pereira, Manuel Lanzini and Eric Lamela were all on the same, according to this person, on the same River Plate team, managed by a guy named Diego Simeone, who were relegated for the first time in their history a few years ago.
Ooh.
Again, don't check it out. I haven't had time to do it. If it's true, I think it's pretty unbelievable.
Next week, Gab will be reading facts from Christmas crackers.
Gab, how about one for you? Real Madrid pummeled in El Clasico. Should that meter be running in a taxi for Lopetegui?
It certainly looks that way. I mean, not because of the defeat. I always think it's really, really stupid when clubs decide, well, if he doesn't win the next game, we'll sack him. In Lopetegui's case, I think the ultimate example that they're not with him is that Sergio Ramos, the club's unofficial director of football and the guy who brought Lopetegui to the club, you know, came out afterwards and said something to the effect of, well, sometimes, you know, being a great tactical manager isn't enough if you're also not a great man manager. You know, speaking generalities, and I'm kind of like, all right, so why did you appoint this guy? But anyway, the funny thing about this game is Real Madrid were absolutely abject for the first 45 minutes. They could have been 4 or 5 goals down. Then, because Barcelona right now still have some issues, and of course they didn't have Lionel Messi, they pulled one back, they hit the woodwork, Benzema wasted a sitter, and then Luis Suarez, who was magnificent in this game, scored, I think, one of the best-headed goals I've ever seen to make it 3-1. And then it was lights out and it finished 5-1. But yes, Real Madrid board are due to meet this evening, I believe, as we record on a Monday morning. And most people expect Lopetegui to be gone. And among the candidates to replace him are former Chelsea manager Antonio Conte, former Wigan manager, and a couple others, Roberto Martinez. And if they can't get either, in-house solution is Santi Solari. Natalie, how about one for you? We spoke a few weeks ago about how Times namesake Paul Hurst had won his first game as Ipswich manager and had maybe turned a corner. I can't believe we're talking about this guy and Ipswich again in less than a month, but how's that working out?
Well, we won't have to talk about him again with regards to Ipswich anyway, because he's been sacked, yes, after the 7th defeat for Ipswich in midweek. He has lost his job along with his assistants. It was very difficult tenure for Hurst, it has to be said. They won just the once. They are bottom of the championship. From my understanding, he made a lot of changes at the club and made a lot of changes too quickly, so it just didn't work out for him.
So wise Mr. Evans made the wise choice?
Well, only time will tell, because obviously everyone was very happy with his appointment, but it didn't quite work out. And now, having lost at Millwall at the weekend, they have now appointed Paul Lambert as their new boss. So another Paul. Ooh.
Paul Lambert,
helm.
Yeah.
Paul Lambert.
I know who he is.
Indeed, you're Paul, familiar with yes. him. And you'll also be familiar that he also used to manage Norwich, the East Anglian rivals.
That's right.
Ipswich, so that'll
and
be
Colchester.
Interesting. And Colchester, yes, he likes that East side.
But then again, Paul Lambert, I think he's a phenomenal and highly underappreciated footballer. But he also strikes me as somebody who really doesn't give two Christians about what about rivalries in the past. I mean, I'm not saying he'd go and manage Glasgow Rangers one day, but if there's somebody who I don't think is going to be affected by the Norwich thing, I would assume it's him.
It's time now for our weekend predictions game, and we were level this season with 4 wins apiece. A reminder how this all works: we get 1 point for a correct result and 3 for a correct scoreline. So let's start with the ones that we got wrong, Gab. We both went for Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds to beat Aitor Karanka's Forest, but that one finished 1-1 at Elland Road in the Championship.
I'm sure Leeds probably deserved it more, right?
Well, they came into it late on, I'd say.
We both thought Arsenal would win at Crystal Palace. Silly us. No such luck for us or our boy Unai Emery. 2-2 at Selhurst Park. We both correctly predicted a draw between Southampton and Newcastle. However, I was the only one who said it would be 0-0. So that's 10 extra points for me.
10? I think you made that up.
Okay, 3.
However, at Old Trafford, I predicted Manchester United would beat Everton, whereas, Gab, you went for the draw. And I also called the correct scoreline of 2-1, so that puts me in front.
My Evertonian friends would point out that it should have never been a penalty because Idrissa Gueye got the ball, but neither here nor there. You know, Clásico, where I do my finest work. Natalie went for a narrow Barcelona win. Ha ha. It was anything but a narrow Barcelona win, but much better than me because I lumped it all on Lopetegui and went for Real Madrid. So I guess I was kind of wrong there.
Just a bit. Meaning, I am victorious this week. 5-4 the score is now to me. I'm in front for the first time, Gab. And don't forget, I was 4-1 down as well.
Yes, and the Paul Hurst of the predictions game.
That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Alison Rudd, Henry Winter, Richard Lloyd-Parrott and Ollie Kay.
And remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and also on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial, which works out to how many pounds for 8 weeks, Natalie?
£8.
Very good.
I don't like quick maths.
So it's a Times subscription for more information.
And we'll be back on Thursday. We're going to be looking ahead to Arsenal versus Liverpool.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.